today's episode, we'll touch on sensitive topics, such as sexual and childhood abuse. So if you are sensitive to this content, please listen at your own discretion. What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hello and welcome to Art Muse, a podcast that aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret well-known works of art by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. While these women's faces are familiar to viewers around the world, their identities have been largely forgotten. Together, we will explore the important lives and legacy of the female muse and appreciate these works of art from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Is the muse in actuality just as, if not more, important than the artists themselves? And I'm your host, Grace Anna. Salvador Dali is one of the most recognizable and respected artists of the 20th century. His persistence of memory is arguably the Museum of Modern Art's most prized possession. His infamous curled mustache has turned Dali into an artistic icon, and his otherworldly paintings continue to bewilder viewers today. But of course, behind every great man is an even greater woman. And this sentiment couldn't be more true than in the case of Salvador Dali. Hidden in the shadows of Dali's massive legacy is the woman who can be credited with making Dali a household name and one of the strongest forces of nature to walk this earth. Listeners, today I introduce you to Gala Dali, the wife and companion of Salvador Dali for over 50 years, who not only inspired Dali's greatest works, many of which feature her image, but managed Dali's entire career, brokering his biggest deals and elevating him from an unknown and impoverished young artist to celebrity status. Dali painted Gala almost obsessively, and she can be found in hundreds of Dali's works under a variety of different guises. But Gala was far more than just model and muse. She was so involved in the conceptualizing of Dali's works, conjuring up her own image, that early in his career, Dali began to sign all of his works with both of their names. And she was equally responsible for Dali's performative persona, the mastermind that foresaw the opportunity in the artist becoming art himself. Gala played a vital role in the creation of not only the works we have come to treasure today, but also the man we have embraced as one of the quirkiest artists of all time. Gala's influence was not limited to Dali's artistic practice. She also acted as his agent, publicist, and accountant, taking charge of all the managerial aspects of Dali's career. It is without a doubt that without Gala and her fearless drive, Dali would likely not be known today. And it was not just the work of Dali that Gala left an indelible impact on. Before Gala even met Dali, she had made waves within the Surrealist movement. She was married to the poet Paul Eluard and was an integral influence on the development of his literary career. She had a heated love affair with Max Ernst, who featured her as the only woman in his group portrait of the Surrealists. And she enjoyed a short romance with the Italian painter Giorgio Di Chirico, who was so impressed with Gala that he asked Gala to become his manager. Gala had a fierce intensity that drove men wild. Before and after her relationship with Dali, there are countless accounts of men falling into a state of desperation over Gala, and she had an almost intimidating power over any man in her wake. As Paul Eluard once said, Gala was, quote, "the woman whose gaze pierces walls," and evidently men's hearts as well. Gala's ferocious spirit grew with the many tribulations she endured through her life. She survived two world wars, the Russian Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, and various health conditions such as tuberculosis. These experiences hardened Gala over time, and her behavior, especially towards the end of her life, turned vicious and cruel, leaving a complicated legacy behind that's hard to reckon with. So who was the woman whose eyes could pierce through walls, who inspired some of the greatest artists of the 20th century and turned these men weak at the knees? Whose name Salvador Dali signed on all of his works, but has today been largely forgotten? Who was Gala Dali? Well, buckle up, listeners, because today you're in for a bumpy ride. Gala, originally Helena Dmitrievna Dianova, was born in 1895 in Kazan, Russia. Gala's father was a gold miner who left his family when Gala was an infant to look for gold in Siberia. When Gala was just 10 years old, she received the news that her father had died in the ice fields of Siberia, leaving behind no money for the survival of their family. Gala's mother was left to care for her, her sister, and her two brothers in poverty. In Russian Orthodox society, widows were expected to remain in mourning and faithful to their deceased husbands indefinitely. But with four children to feed, Gala's mother braved society's scorn and looked for a new husband. Her mother soon after entered a relationship with a wealthy lawyer who took Gala and her family in to live with him in his extravagant home. Her mother's act of defiance seems to have left an enduring impact on the young Gala, who inherited her mother's fierce personality and learned at a young age to never let society's limitations stop her from achieving greatness. Moving into her stepfather's house was an abrupt shift for Gala and her family. They quickly went from poverty to having cooks, nannies, and servants. And this newfound wealth came with many perks. The family would spend their summers traveling throughout Russia and Europe at large. One summer, they took a train south to the Black Sea, and another they traveled to Finland, where Gala fell in love for the first time with the hotel telegraphist. Another major advantage of the family's new financial situation was that Gala's stepfather could fund her education. When Gala was a teenager, her family moved to Moscow, where she attended a prestigious academy for women. She proved to be a bright student with well above average grades. Her family instilled in her a particular passion for literature, and Gala would spend her days reading, her favorite being the work of Dostoevsky. Although she was not allowed to enroll in university as a woman, she would often attend lectures open to the public on literature, and had dreams of becoming a translator of poetry and novels from French to Russian. After she finished school, she was authorized by a degree from the Tsar to become a primary school teacher. As her sister remembered, quote, "Gala was always very clear and intelligent. She was the most practical of us all." But her upbringing was certainly not pain-free. Later in life, Gala revealed that her stepfather raped her as a young teenager, an unspeakable trauma that Gala evidently hid from her family. This trauma would shape her life in silent and haunting ways, and may have been part of why, many years later, she would bond with another victim of childhood sexual abuse, Salvador Dali. Another childhood hardship that would plague Gala for the rest of her life was her poor health. Ever since a young child, Gala was particularly petite and frail. Her siblings would make fun of her because her health compromised her ability to keep up with their tennis, riding, and rowing lessons. Her sister, who was 7 years her younger, remembers carrying Gala from the bath to her bed. Gala in particular had weak lungs and lymph nodes. Because of this, Gala spent much of her younger years in and out of health clinics and sanatoriums in Moscow. In 1912, Galla's lungs reached a perilous state, and out of fear of developing tuberculosis, her doctor suggested that Galla be treated at a specialized sanatorium in Switzerland called Clavidel. Her family obliged, and her stepfather financed her travels and treatment. At just 17 years old, and in extremely brittle health, Galla made the long journey from Russia to Switzerland all by herself. Galla wouldn't have known as she boarded the train and waved goodbye to her family from the window that this decision would forever change the course of her life. As her train departed Russia, she would never return the same. In a foreign country with no friends or family, Galla picked her favorite novels to keep her company. She spent these beginning days at the sanatorium reading in her room, feeling estranged from her significantly older fellow patients. But soon she caught a glimpse of a young and handsome French boy with big blue eyes and dressed in the latest Parisian fashion. And Galla knew she would not have to be alone anymore. Paul Eugene Grindel, who preferred to go by his grandmother's maiden name, Eluard, was an aspiring young poet from Paris. And it didn't take long for Galla to be swept off her feet. But Galla had competition. And at first, another young French girl was also pining after Eluard. Galla, who was not raised in a religious household, prayed to God for maybe the first time in her life that this boy of her dreams could be hers. And her prayers were answered. Galla and Eluard immediately bonded over their shared love for literature and began spending every moment they could together, reading the poetry of Walt Whitman, drawing each other's portrait, and teaching each other words in the other's language. Soon, Eluard shared his own poetry with Galla, who encouraged his work and helped him decide on his pen name, Paul Eluard. Encased by the snowy Swiss mountains and away from their families and lives back home, Galla and Eluard were able to open up to each other in ways that would only have been possible given their specific circumstances. Sharing the experience of illness and being together confined within the sanatorium granted Galla and Eluard a special intimacy and understanding of each other. They would have also been reminded on a daily basis of the fragility of life, that the same nights that they whispered their sweet love to each other, many of the patients around them were taking their last breaths, and the sight of the dead being carted away from the now empty rooms would have not been uncommon. By the end of their 4 years together at Clavidel, Galla and Eluard were making plans to share their lives together outside the sanatorium. By 1914, Galla's health improved enough for her to return to her family in Russia, and Eluard to return to Paris. Before they parted ways, Eluard proposed an unofficial engagement. On the long train ride back to Russia, Galla must have had to coax the pangs in her heart over their separation. And not only would they need to navigate the complexities of living on nearly opposite sides of the continent, but as they said their goodbyes, Europe was on the brink of war. In fact, Galla's train back to Russia traversed the Austrian border just as the Habsburg Empire declared war against Russia. We can only imagine how scary it must have been for Galla to travel through enemy territory, with war just on the horizon. Galla returned to the unsettling news that her brother had been recruited into the Russian army. Eluard soon after got drafted into the French army, but due to his poor health, he was spared the trenches and instead put to work at a hospital. Galla must not only have been disheartened by the harrowing, growing political situation, but by the inevitable challenges it added to reuniting with Eluard. But not only World War I could abate Galla's determination to move to France and begin her life with Eluard. As time went on and as the political climate worsened, Galla's willpower only strengthened. As her sister remembered, quote, Gala even started to get a temperature out of the sheer longing for him. Gala began begging her parents to allow her to travel to France, and when they understandably said no, she went on a hunger strike. Her parents were no match for Gala's will, and they eventually surrendered. Because Russia and France were allies, Gala and Ellulard were fortunately able to write each other regularly, and Ellulard shared with Gala a plan for her to move to France. It would be dangerous, especially given Gala's frail health. But Gala was not deterred by the prospect of danger. Gala would take a series of trains from Russia to Sweden and then a boat to France. And so, in 1916, at only 21 years old, Gala left behind the security of her family and traveled by herself across Europe at the peak of World War I for a completely foreign land and a life unknown. How did Gala feel as she took the perilous journey through the worst of the war to a country she had never before been? Was she nervous, frightened, or was she filled with the resolute faith that her life was just about to really begin? Gala arrived safely in Paris in August of 1916. With her travel case filled with Russian novels and her best clothes, and the little pocket money that she had, Gala set out to meet Ellulard, who was on furlough from the army. The dark shadow of war hung high above Paris, and Gala would have been much more face-to-face with the horrors of World War I than she had in Russia. Was Gala nervous about her reunion with Ellulard? Was she worried that they may no longer be compatible, that the war had changed Ellulard, and that she had made a mistake? Luckily, Gala and Ellulard enjoyed a sweet reunion, and she soon after moved into his parents' apartment while Ellulard returned to the war front. In Paris, she was at the mercy of Ellulard's mother, who treated Gala coldly and with distrust and dislike. She was resentful of Gala's privileged upbringing, which made itself evident when Gala didn't know how to do simple household tasks. Gala, who had risked her life and abandoned her family to be in Paris, must have felt incredibly alone and unwelcomed. When the tension became unbearable, Gala would become bedridden with depressive thoughts. As Gala recalled to Ellulard, quote, I was very tired and sad. I thought of all that was saddest in my anxious life. When I was a little girl, it was the sadness of my parents, then our separation, our sickness, our love. Gala would take refuge in Ellulard's room and wear his sweaters to feel his closeness. She wrote to Ellulard of a psychic connection with him that she felt, and of her increasing worry over his well-being. This fear was worsened when Ellulard decided to join the infantry and fight on the front line. This decision, while initially angering Gala, strengthened the couple's resolve to get married as soon as possible. Ellulard took 4 days' leave from the army to get married and enjoy a short honeymoon with Gala. They were married in February of 1917, and by August of that year, Gala was already pregnant with their first and only child. Ellulard rushed back from the front line to be by Gala's side for her delivery, and Gala gave birth to a healthy girl, whom they named Cecile. How did Gala feel as she looked into her daughter's newborn eyes? What was she thinking as she cradled Cecile for the first time? In all of Gala's letters to Ellulard, her long descriptions of their dream life together, not once did Gala mention the desire to be a mother. As we will see, Gala had little interest in motherhood and likely felt a sense of overwhelm and dread. But though she possessed little natural inclination towards motherhood, she did start to show her impressive ability to nurture artistic talent. In 1919, Elulard was discharged from the army and began to focus on his poetry career. Galla inspired much of Elulard's poetry, but she was much more than just a source of inspiration. Galla began to exert a powerful influence on Elulard's artistic practice, guiding Elulard as he discovered his poetic voice, carefully reviewing each poem before it was published, and she even wrote the preface to one of his early volumes. With Galla's help, Elulard soon worked his way into the emerging Surrealist movement. And Galla and Elulard not only shared in the Surrealist artistic vision, but also in the movement's quest for sexual exploration. Galla and Elulard were extremely sexually forward, and the erotica was a fundamental aspect of their relationship. This is evident in the hundreds of surviving letters Elulard wrote to Galla over the course of their marriage, in which he talks of his constant, insatiable desire for Galla. But their sexual desire was not limited to each other, and both Galla and Elulard enjoyed numerous consensual affairs. One of their most noteworthy sexual adventures was with the German painter Max Ernst. In 1922, Galla and Elulard joined Ernst and his wife and baby for a trip in the Austrian Alps. Ernst's wife, Lou, soon noticed that Ernst was sneaking out each night to join Galla and Elulard in their bed. Galla and Elulard were thrilled to include Ernst in their nighttime play. When Lou confronted Ernst, he confessed that he found Galla to be more passionate than her. Lou began to despise Galla, describing her as, quote, "that slithering, glittering creature with dark falling hair, vaguely oriental with luminant black eyes and small delicate bones, who had to remind one of a panther." But Ernst was so infatuated with Galla and Elulard, Galla in particular, that he soon after abandoned his wife Lou and young son Jimmy, leaving them in poverty, to join Galla and Elulard in Paris. And thus was the start of a menage a trois relationship between Galla, Elulard, and Ernst. Ernst moved in with Galla, Elulard, and baby Cecile. Elulard soon found them a larger villa in the Parisian suburbs that they could all comfortably share. The home had a large garden, where Galla raised chickens. Ernst paid Elulard and Galla back for their hospitality by painting frescoes on the walls of each room. Galla, Ernst, and Elulard slept in the same bed together every single night. Galla became the center of attention and affection of not one, but two men, and she couldn't have been happier. The home became a gathering point for artists and creatives alike, and artists flocked to the suburbs to visit the villa. The trio would also host spiritualist gatherings and hold seances and read tarot. Galla, who many noted had unusual intuitive and spiritual power, would play high priestess, floating around the house wearing a floor-length silk robe. One can only imagine what out-of-body experiences transpired in that villa, as Cecile was fast asleep in her crib. As the lover of not one, but two prominent surrealists, Galla was one of the few women to infiltrate the predominantly male movement. In many ways, Galla fit right in. With her dark hair and razor-sharp glare, she had both an air of mystery and mystical power that evoked a sense of awe. She was notorious for her love of the erotic, perhaps even outdoing many of her male comrades in her sexual forwardness. Galla met Pablo Picasso, who invited her to his studio and offered her any piece she wanted. Her portrait was taken by the renowned photographer Man Ray. She had a brief affair with the Italian painter Giorgio Di Carico, who was so impressed with Galla that he asked her to manage his career, which she declined. In fact, it was a known saying among the surrealists that if an artist was working well, he was said to be in love with Galla. Ernst paid homage to Galla in his painting Rendezvous of Friends, in which Gala is the only woman pictured amongst the most important members of the Surrealist movement. Gala stares at us over her shoulder, confidently and proud, smirking as if unimpressed by our presence. Though not an artist herself, Gala's ability to inspire creation and nurture artistic output was worthy enough to put her on equal plane as the men around her. And these men became increasingly dependent on and desperate for her inspiration. As Ernst and Gala grew closer and closer, Ellulard slowly became insecure and jealous, worrying that he was increasingly being spaced out of their relationship. Hitting a breaking point, Ellulard packed his bags and set out for a solo trip around the world, a self-imposed exile of sorts. Instead of despairing over his absence, as Ellulard had hoped, Gala and Ernst took a romantic trip to Germany together. Soon, Ellulard found that he began to desperately miss them. He began to send letters begging Gala and Ernst to join him in Asia. They obliged, and Gala auctioned off Ellulard's art collection to pay for her and Ernst's tickets for the long journey. The trio reunited in Saigon, but it was not the happy reunion that they had all hoped for. For reasons unknown, Ernst decided to break things off with Gala and Ellulard, shattering their two-year-long menage a trois. Gala and Paul returned together to Paris, and Ernst stayed behind, wandering around Asia on his own. If Gala was sad about Ernst, it wouldn't last for long. For there was another surrealist painter on her horizon, and once they met, they would never leave each other's side. In August of 1929, Ellulard planned a family trip down to Cadaqués, Spain, to visit a young surrealist painter named Salvador Dalí. Ellulard had hoped that this trip would reunite his family and strengthen his marriage to Gala, which had become frayed after years of their respective affairs. Gala, on the other hand, was ready for her next romance. Feeling a void in her life, she longed to fall deeply in love and pour herself into another artist's creations. Cecile, who spent most of her time with Ellulard's mother, must have been thrilled to be traveling with her parents. As Gala, Ellulard, and Cecile packed themselves into their car to take the long drive down to Spain, their eyes gleamed with hopeful anticipation. But the drive was far from glamorous. It took several long days. The medication that Ellulard took for his tuberculosis made his hands shake, which subsequently led to jolty driving. Gala was in a foul mood, and the collective hope and promise must have dissipated early on into the trip. When they finally arrived at the only hotel in Cadaqués, Gala was furious to find that there was no running water or electricity. And to make matters worse, the painter they drove all this way to meet was a complete oddball, whose eccentric antics left Gala unimpressed. This wasn't the romantic trip that Gala had envisioned, and Dalí was not the handsome and charming man that Ellulard had led her to believe he was. Gala was ready to pack her bags and return home immediately. But while Dalí left Gala underwhelmed, Dalí fell in love with Gala at first sight. He later admitted that he knew Gala was the woman of his dreams the moment he laid eyes on her. And it wasn't just her looks that got Dalí immediately hooked, but it was how he felt around her. His lifelong crippling anxiety that had cursed him his whole life was magically lifted in Gala's presence. By the end of this first evening, Gala's initial dislike began to fade, and she warmed up to Dalí. As they said goodbye, they agreed to meet on the beach the following morning. At daybreak, Dalí was awoken by his nerves. He desperately wanted to impress Gala. To make a bold statement, he turned his swimming trunks inside out and began to slash massive holes in his shirt. He then purposefully cut his underarms while shaving and let them bleed out, and made a concoction of fish glue and goat manure to wear as cologne. But as he looked out the window and saw a topless Gala already on the beach, he realized that his antics borderlined lunacy, and he hurriedly scrubbed his body and changed his outfit in hopes he could reverse the damage. When he finally made it to the beach, Dali opened his mouth to greet Gala, but found that whenever he tried to speak, he was struck with uncontrollable laughter. Luckily for Dali, his inability to speak did not prevent the two from better understanding each other. As Dali recalled, quote, "With her medium-like intuition, she understood the exact meaning of my laughter, so inexplicable to everyone else." With each mishap, Gala found Dali increasingly more endearing, and soon she began to believe that she, too, had found her soulmate. She turned to Dali and exclaimed, "My little boy, we shall never leave each other." And she was right. Despite their 10-year age difference, Gala being 35 and Dali 25, it didn't take long for the pair to become inseparable. They met at an opportune time in each of their lives. Gala had begun to feel increasingly aimless in her life with Elu Lard. She no longer contributed to his career's success, and their affairs created an emotional distancing between them. She grew tired of the surrealist, relentless weekly intellectual debates, and Elulard's mother was possessive over Cecile. Her life craved a new purpose, and Dali, a highly impressionable young artist with immense artistic potential, but lacking the courage or clue how to manage his own career, was the answer to her prayers. As Dali later reflected, quote, "She wanted something, something which would be the fulfillment of her own myth." In Dali, Gala knew that she could not only bolster Dali's career, but she could reinvent herself and become the master of her myth. And for Dali, who suffered from numerous phobias and crippling anxiety for much of his life, Gala provided an emotional comfort that he had never before experienced. Dali was especially vulnerable and sensitive, and Gala, 10 years his elder, could take charge of his life in a way that made Dali feel protected. This would eventually make Dali unhealthily dependent on Gala and blind to her sometimes manipulative behavior. Nevertheless, what Elu Lard at first may have dismissed as a harmless affair was soon becoming more and more serious before his eyes. Elu Lard became progressively more distressed over Gala and Dali's growing connection. When he reached his wit's end, he told Gala that it was time for them to return to Paris. But, to Elu Lard's dismay, Gala refused to leave Dali. Shocked and confused, the heartbroken Elu Lard packed his bags and left Spain alone, leaving his wife and daughter behind. With each day, Elu Lard helplessly prayed that Gala would come to her senses and return to him. His hope that the trip would reunite his marriage had almost embarrassingly blown up in his face. To rub salt in the wound, just before leaving for Spain, Elu Lard had bought a new, extremely expensive apartment in Paris for him, Gala, and Cecile to live in. He spent a significant portion of his inheritance from his father's death and sold his beloved paintings by Picasso and Di Carico to afford it. In fact, he specifically purchased the apartment to quell Gala's continued complaints that she felt trapped in their old home. By the time he returned from Spain, he had Gala's closets filled with stylish dresses fresh from the best designers. And he had faith that this new apartment would bring with it more family time, and that Gala and Cecile would spend more time together. As he walked the now empty halls of this apartment alone, halls decorated with pictures of his wife, Elu Lard must have felt that it made a mockery of his marriage. Gala, with a heavily neglected Cecile, finally returned to Paris that September. Upon arrival, Gala announced that Dalí would be joining them by November. Though Gala continued to live with Eluard, she was consumed with Dalí, even in his absence, and spent the next few weeks editing his writings into a coherent manuscript. What was Gala thinking during those weeks in Paris as she awaited Dalí's arrival? Did she still love Eluard, despite her growing affection for Dalí? Was she unsure if she could or would officially leave Eluard for Dalí? Could she trust Dalí, even with his quirks and anxieties? Was she weighing out her options? Not only would leaving Eluard and Cécile have moral consequences, but Gala would be forgoing a life of financial stability and comfort for a life unknown. But when Dalí arrived that November, Gala realized that she loved Dalí and believed in his creative genius enough to take that risk. She followed her heart and intuition and officially left Eluard and Cécile for Dalí. Eluard was left to pick up the pieces of his broken marriage, and Cécile was sent to live with her grandmother indefinitely. While her family was left shattered, Gala and Dalí took off for a romantic trip to Barcelona and then returned to Dalí's home in Cadaqués. But there was also no warm welcome from Dalí's family. Dalí's father and sister were vehemently against Dalí's relationship with Gala, understandably concerned that she was a married woman 10 years his elder. Dalí was banished from his family. And while he would one day repair his relationship with his father, Dalí's sister would not speak to him again for another 30 years. With no one to turn to but each other, their respective breaks from their families only strengthened the bond between Gala and Dalí. They spent the next few months alone in southern France, locked in a room filled with paints and canvases, with the curtains tightly shut. As Dalí remembered, quote, "Gala understood that we had to flee the world so as to temper ourselves as a couple in the crucible of life alone together." As Gala and Dalí shut out the world, Eluard's world felt like it was increasingly collapsing. In letters that still survive today, Eluard pleaded with Gala to return to him. In one, he desperately wrote, "Gala, if the thought comes to me that all could be finished between us, I truly feel like someone condemned to death. And what a death." But Gala coldly silenced Eluard's pleas to return and officially asked for a divorce. She knew that she had found in Dalí a rare soulmate that only fate could have led her to. In many ways, Gala and Dalí were born for each other, beings belonging to the same bizarre species of human. They both had troubled childhoods and suffered abuse. They both preferred to self-mythologize and hide behind a persona of their creation. And they both had a gift for grabbing and holding the public imagination. They found in each other what their respective lives had been so desperately missing, and understood early on that each could provide to the other what they needed to reach their highest potential. Gala knew that there was no turning back, and though the path ahead was filled with unknowns, she understood that the greatest adventure of her life was about to begin. I hope you have enjoyed part one of our two-part episode on Gala Dalí. We will finish Gala's gripping story and together examine her complicated legacy in part two of this episode. I have included images, resources, and suggestions for further reading on the Art Muse website and Instagram. Art Muse is produced by Kula Production Company. Today's episode was written by me, your host, Grace Anna. Until next time. Bye for now.